Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Blackburn, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the Kootenai River, Big, Bold, and Beautiful. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Blackburn about the Kootenai River. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give back something to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dave's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a fishing hat and T-shirt, courtesy of Dave Blackburn and his shop up in Montana. And to win that gift tonight, you'll have to answer the question at the end of the show. And the question will be about something Dave and I talk about during the show. And the first person to put in the correct answer in the text box on our homepage will win that hat and T-shirt. So use your best typing skills, and you're going to get a hat and a T-shirt. We can all use that. That's for sure. So listen carefully. Tonight, our guest is Dave Blackburn. Dave started tying flies and fly fishing at the age of 10 when his sixth grade teacher introduced him to the sport. Having grown up in Pennsylvania, he was schooled on many of the classic limestone streams of the East. He graduated from West Virginia University with a BS in Forest Resource Management with an emphasis on water quality and aquatic ecology. He traveled westward chasing wild trout tails and gained employment as a wilderness ranger in the Bighorn National Forest in Wyoming. In 1981, he ended up in Montana on the banks of the Kootenai River, where he now resides with his wife, Tammy, and three children. He is on the board of directors for the Kootenai Valley Trout Club. He has been the past director of the Fishing Outfitters Association of Montana and the Montana Council of Trout Unlimited. They've chaired the Upper Kootenai River Preservation Society, which was instrumental in defeating the Jennings Rapids Dam project. Dave is a Federation of Fly Fishers certified casting instructor and a contract tier for Umpqua Feather Merchants. He teaches fly tying and fly fishing at Flathead Community College. His photos and articles have appeared in Fly Fisherman, Fly Rod and Reel, and Fly Fisher magazines. Well, Dave, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, I think we'll have fun tonight talking about Montana fishing, which is always good fishing in my book. So I'm looking forward to it, and we got lots of stuff to cover. So let's dive right in, and we're going to try to give our listeners tonight a good picture of what the Kootenai River is and what it's about and the things around it as well. So Let's just start out with the river itself and talk about where it all begins. Where are the headwaters and how does it flow? Maybe you can kind of give us an overall quick track of the river.
Well, it basically flows south out of British Columbia. Its origins are in British Columbia's Kootenai National Park. Now, Kootenai actually is the American pronunciation. The Canadian pronunciation is Kootenai. They even spell it differently up there. Instead of K-O-O-T-E-N-A-I, it's T-E-N-A-Y. So that's the A part of Canada. What can I say?
Okay.
So basically, it comes south, and then it hits Montana, turns west, flows through the Idaho Panhandle, and flows right back up into British Columbia again. So we have about a 50-mile stretch that we fish that's in Montana.
Okay.
In fact, this year we just got licensed to fish the Idaho section, and that's about 14, 15 miles before it goes back up into British Columbia.
So where does the name come from?
Actually, Dave Thompson was the one that first named the Indians in this area. They were called the Kootenais, and it's actually an Indian. The Indian spelling is K-U-T-E-N-A-I, and it actually means deer robes. The early traders in the area always were forewarned to not ooh and ah over the deer robes that the Kootenai Indians tanned because they'd have to pay a higher price for them, but they were well known for their tan deer robes of this area, so hence that's where the name Kootenai came from.
Now, there's a lot more history to this river, and we could probably talk a whole hour on just the history, but can you kind of give us a brief?
We sure could. Well, you know, you have to talk about the size of it first, and it's the second largest river in Montana, but it's actually the second largest tributary of the Columbia River, and basically, when Dave Thompson first mapped this area in the early 1800s, and he came through here, hence the name Thompson Falls, close to Trout Creek, Montana. We have a Dave Thompson Bridge here, and there's all kinds of Thompson names. And actually, I have to mention that Dave Thompson, there was a book by a fellow by the name of Nesbitt, and he coined the term that if Lewis and Clark, he basically called them Boy Scouts compared to the wilderness surveyor that Dave Thompson was, because he logged over 55,000 miles of surveys in the Pacific Northwest. He didn't get all the recognition because he wasn't an American, he was a Canadian. And so Dave Thompson was the first guy that came through here, and of course, as gold was discovered in our adjacent area with Canada, with Libby, the name Libby actually came from the miner's daughter that found the gold nugget up at the Snowshoe Mine at a creek called Libby Creek. And so it all started kind of as a gold rush, silver rush type of thing, but they found ore up in Canada, and they used to run sternwheel steamboats between Jennings Rapids and the Canadian. It would go up to the gold fields around Fort Nelson, British Columbia. And the major route to Western Canada came right through the river I'm looking at right now, going up to, because it was the Canadian Pacific Railroad had not been joined yet, coast to coast, so the main trade route was right through Jennings, which is about a half mile downstream from where I'm sitting in my office overlooking the river right now. And lots of history about different, you know, trade with Canada and different things there. So, I mean, I could go on and on.
Sure.
This is one of those things.
I imagine there's some political things that have to take place with Canada and the U.S. just as far as the water rights and so forth.
Sure. Actually, the dam, the actual river, pre-dam years, you know, I wasn't here then, but from all reports from the old-timers that fished the river before the dam, in fact, the Kootenai River is a tailwater fishery for those of you that aren't familiar with it. It comes out of Canada, and as it comes in the United States, there's about a 35-mile stretch that is a lake, and it's called Lake Coconusa. And it was formed when they built Libby Dam. It was dedicated in 1973 by Gerald Ford. It backs up 90 miles of water, half in the United States and half in Canada. The lake's name is actually called Coconusa. Everybody thinks it's an Indian name, but it's really not. It was named by a local lady that submitted the name to a contest, and the K-O-O comes from Kootenai River, and then C-A-N-U-S-A is the treaty that exists between Canada and the United States. So that's why the name Kookanoosa got adapted.
I would have never have guessed.
Yep.
So makes total sense now, but...
Right, right. And, of course, you know, there's a certain amount of power, you know, profits that go into Canada. They consider, the Canadians aren't real happy about the fact that Libby Dam got built because the fishing in Kootenai Lake, which the Kootenai eventually runs back up into and then drains into a finger arm in the upper Columbia, they consider Libby Dam being a nutrient trap where a lot of the nutrients are held back by the dam walls and so forth, and the fishing in that Kootenai Lake has deteriorated since Libby Dam was formed.
Okay. So now the section you fish is where? Describe that.
Well, basically my residence is about 3 miles below the dam. We have 60 acres, and we fish every section of the Kootenai and float it with the exception of Kootenai Falls. The Kootenai Falls section, a lot of folks saw in the movie River Wild. It was the section of the river that they called the Gauntlet, and that was quite a project when they made that movie with Meryl Streep and Kevin Bacon.
I remember that, yeah.
Yep, and so it actually portrays the canyon area, which is right directly below Kootenai Falls, but she actually did not row the Gauntlet. It was done by trick photography using the cameras and so forth. That section of the river with, there's a few places where whitewater kayakers will have their play sports teams go down and ride waves and do different things. But there still is a very dangerous area that they even stay out of now, and that's called the Gauntlet. And it's a big, huge keeper wave. In fact, when they made the movie River Wild, Meryl Streep's double was strapped into a raft with a harness around her, and a helicopter was attached to that harness by a rope. And they took the raft down into this big keeper wave, and they lifted Meryl Streep's double out of the raft, and the raft came up about a month later after it was held down in the bottom by, you know, turbulence and that type of thing. So it's some pretty serious whitewater for sure. There's been several deaths over the years with people trying to, you know, navigate that section of the river. Some swimmers fall in and are drug under by undertow and that type of thing. So it's nothing to mess around with. It's some pretty dangerous water.
Definitely not a place for your drift boat, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
Well, so that stretch, so you're fishing, you start with the tailwaters below the dam, I take it, and then...
Right.
And how many miles of river is fishable there?
Well, there's about, let's see, above the town of Libby, there's 17 miles of floatable water. Below Libby is about 7 miles, and then there's about 2 more miles until you get to a spot where you have to, you know, either carry your raft or pontoon boat. There's no drift boat takeout in this section, but you can float it with a rubber raft and then just take out above Kootenai Falls. And then there's the falls area is actually about half a mile in length. And then below Kootenai Falls, it becomes very slow and deep. And that's the section that has white sturgeon in it, which is an endangered species that they've been augmenting flows for in the last 10 or so years. Then it goes basically into deep, slow water all the way into Idaho, and then it turns north and, of course, becomes the upper or the lower Kootenai above Kootenai Lake, which some of the Canadians call the upper Kootenai. So,
okay.
It changes characteristics quite a bit. You know, lots of different flows. You know, there's lots of good riffles, deep runs. And, you know, I've always told folks, because it's a dam-controlled fishery, it's like the Mars bars of Western rivers. It's 10 rivers in one, where, you know, it might be at a minimum flow river, which it's close to right now. Some places are easily weighted and that type of thing. But then it goes up to, you know, 25,000 at maximum powerhouse capacity. They have 5 turbines. On Libby Dam, and each generates between 5,000 and 6,000 cubic feet per second. And so it just changes the whole characteristics of the river at all the different flows. And, you know, basically you have like 10 different rivers.
Well, now, is the best fishing then between the dam and Kootenai Falls?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
In fact, we saw a little bit of a change in that, you know, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, of course, they do electrofishing. And they give population estimates depending on sections and that type of thing. And the section that's below Kootenai Falls has been gaining in numbers. In fact, with the nutrient enhancement project, which is taking place at the Idaho line, they're actually dumping in phosphorus and nitrogen in the lower Kootenai to try to promote more weed bed growth and add more biomass to the river. And it's been working effectively for, they've been doing it now for about 5 years. And so a lot of people think, you know, the top 3 miles of the river is the best fishing, and it might have the best numbers of fish. But, you know, it isn't always the case, you know, like when I went down to the San Juan River in New Mexico, everybody's crowded up right at the base of the dam fishing. And that does happen here somewhat, but, you know, we just don't see the big, huge crowds that some of the other big tailwater fisheries have. So the fish populations vary depending even on flows. You know, there's seasonal migrations that take place in the river that, you know, we've kind of made notes of as guides being on the river with the amount of time that we've been. And at minimum flow, in fact, right now, the upper section is closed for spawning, and you can't even fish up there now, and a lot of the fish have moved up into the tributaries. So go ahead. I'm sure you have some specific questions, too.
Well, I want to talk more about the river, but I'm just curious as to what the topography is like around the river in this section.
Okay, well, basically, the topography here, we're considered the banana belt of Montana, because of the fact that we're the lowest elevation in Montana, and we also have the lowest incidence of, you know, winds and that type of thing in extreme weather. Where the Kootenai River goes into the Idaho border, it's about 1,800 feet above sea level. That's pretty low when you consider, you know, what the high line is in the Bozeman area and all that type of thing. Our valley floor is at 2,000 feet, and the tops of the mountains here, this is where the Rocky Mountain front meets the Pacific Northwest climate zones, and so there's basically mountains that go up to about 8,800 feet in the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness, and we also have another range called the Purcell Range. So the tops of the mountains in the area where Libby Dam is are up to about 4,000 to 5,000 feet, and then as you approach Libby, you'll see the Cabinet Mountains that range about another 3,000 feet above that, and it's basically a very wet spring and fall traditionally, but very dry summers. And so we have the Pacific Northwest climate in the fall and the spring, but in the summer it's pretty much straight western and not a whole lot of rainfall and that type of thing. And so it's an interesting area. And basically the climax forest in the area is a spruce in the upper spruce and subalpine fir in the higher elevations. But along the river's edge, we have a lot of larch and, basically Douglas fir and larch. And then, of course, you have the traditional cottonwoods along the river's bank and that type of thing. So very similar to some of the other western rivers in Montana
okay.
as well.
Okay. We need to take a quick break, Dave, but when we return, we'll talk more about the Kootenai River.
Very good.
Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing, the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's W-Y-O-Trout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. That's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Blackburn about the Kootenai River, big, bold, and beautiful. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, you may have already answered this question, Dave. Well, I just want to kind of finish up this with the river, and then we'll talk about fishing. But what makes the Kootenai different from other rivers in Montana?
Well, it was the latest. Of course, when you talk about the river, you have to talk about the dam. And, you know, dams are a blessing and a curse. They're a catch-22 for fishermen. And we've seen both sides. In fact, it's a constant political battle to, you know, maintain flows and fish-friendly environments below dams when you have so many power dollars and endangered species at stake. So basically what makes the Kootenai difference is, number one, we're not close to any major airport. We're about 3.5 hours, 3 to 3.5 hours from the closest interstate, where the closest airport would be Glacier International, about 2 hours away. And so the Kootenai just does not receive the fishing pressure that some of the other rivers in Montana receive, where it's almost similar to a carnival-type atmosphere, like during the salmon fly hatch on the Big Hole, where you have, you know, 100 rigs parked at the takeout and that type of thing. On a busy day, you might see 4 to 5 boats on a particular section with a few pontoon boats and that type of thing. But you have to look at, you know, the characteristic of, you know, what the river is in itself. And when the dam was completed, it was the last big hydropower project of its era. And basically, that means that we had all the latest technology go into the dam. And so we now have selective withdrawal, which maintains a constant temperature for the fish. And since we made a lot of very good, as over the years, there were power peaking flows and that type of thing, and we made some very good progress in terms of how the dams run. And power peaking flows meant they would run the dam basically like a water faucet. And if people got up in the morning and turned their coffee makers and toasters on, they would crank the flows up, and then it would drop down at the end of the day. And since then, we've been able to negotiate with the Bonneville Power Administration, and we now have flat flows for the season. Flat flows meaning that we do have seasonal changes, but we don't have daily changes in flows. That really helps the weed beds, you know, maintain growth and the insects and that type of thing. And, you know, it's the biggest tailwater fishery in Montana. So basically it's like the biggest spring creek. Now, it is glacier fed, and we don't have the same growth rate that they do in the eastern side of Montana. It seems like it's more alkaline over there, where we're more acidy base water. And so we don't have, you know, like, for instance, on the Missouri River, they get a 13, 14-inch fish in about a year and a half, 2 years. It takes our fish another year to get that size. And so, you know, it's another factor involved with this river that makes it totally different than the rest of the rivers is it's never been stocked. When the railroads came into Montana, that's when they brought rainbow and brown trout in and just dumped them in just about every river in Montana, with the exception of the Kootenai. And when Lewis and Clark came through, of course, they talked about the greenback trout. And, of course, the cutthroats are the only native trout to eastern Montana. But the western part of the state, we have a Columbia interior red band rainbow that's indigenous to the Columbia River system, which goes into the coast. So that is really a cool thing. In fact, some folks just like a bird list. They like to go to certain rivers to catch native species. And so that's a big draw for the Kootenai. Plus, I've always told people, you know, I think they're the strongest rainbows in Montana. And nothing taken away from some of the other rivers, but these fish will be football shaped. They'll jump, you know, 7 to 10 times a lot of times when you hook them. And they're great fish.
Well, let's talk more about this fish in a minute, but I did want to ask you about your, you know, what role do you play up there on the Kootenai? You have a business. Tell us about your business and what other things you might be involved with.
Well, basically, I came up here with my wife in the early 80s, and I was a wilderness ranger in Wyoming, and I met her down there, and she said, well, let's go up to Montana, and you can meet my family. And so, you know, this is basically in the Bighorn Mountains, which is close to Sheridan, Wyoming. We were on the other side in Grable. And so about 14 hours later, we're still driving to this northwest corner of Montana. And it was just, you know, it was, of course, it was dark by then. And I pull into where we're staying, where I met my father-in-law, my future father-in-law. And I heard this river. And, of course, the next morning, I got up and basically I had this unbelievable experience fishing, you know, a kid from Pennsylvania that's used to fishing with, you know, an 8-foot four weight rod with standard dry fly hooks. I went up to an area, what we call now the rocky point of the home pool, and could not believe the strength of fish that were leaving my hooks just straightened out like hairpins. I was breaking off, you know, 5X tippet like there's no tomorrow. And so basically, I had a love affair with the river instantly from that point on. And of course, you know, being from Pennsylvania, seeing the role that fishermen played in politics back there, I had a very strong sense of, you know, like, for instance, you know, you pick up litter when you walk along the river, and you also fight for, you know, your fish's rights, so to speak. And so when we saw degrading power peaking practices on the river and that type of thing, when we saw dam proposals come along for damming another 10 miles of the river after Libby Dam was built, of course, we got actively involved, and we were able to stop a dam that would have put my property 80 feet under the river. And so we've been basically like a political watchdog up here, and it's a never-ending job, and we have a local trout club that helps with that. But we've made a lot of progress over the years, but, you know, there's still a lot more to be made. You know, when anadromous fish on the coast can take precedence, you know, well, somebody has to go to bat for them. And that basically, consider myself a Kootenai River trout advocate at this point.
Okay, good for you. Now, what about your business?
Well, I started guiding for a gentleman by the name of Lynn Berlin, who was a hunting outfitter in the early 80s. And I guided for him for a while, and then I took my outfitting test and started Kootenai Angler in 1982. And we started with just an old wooden boat. I didn't have any cabins then, but we had some nice property along the river. And we, in 1996, we moved a fly shop into Libby. I had a fly shop connected to my house for about 10 years previously to that. And basically, that evolved into nonstop people in your face. And when that happens in your home and things aren't exactly happy all the time with spouses and kids, and I decided it was time to maybe make the move into town. So we had a fly shop in Libby for 10 years, and in 2007 we moved it out to where we currently have a restaurant now. And so we have a 60-acre area along the river that has about 3/4 of a mile of river frontage on it, with 5 different cabins along with the restaurant and fly shop. But, you know, it isn't something that came overnight. We built the first cabin in 92, second one in 96, and so, you know, we just built it a little bit at a time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, why don't you give people your website address so that in case they want to
The website address is just montana-flyfishing.com. Make sure you put a dash in there, and that'll get you right onto our website.
Good, good. Well, let's talk about seasons up there on the river. Are there seasons either mandatory by law or weather-related that we need to be aware of if we want to travel up there to fish?
Well, there's just basically the nothing dependent on the weather. In fact, in the old days before the dam, they said the river would freeze all the way across in certain areas and couldn't be fishable, but that doesn't happen anymore because the dam, you know, keeps the water a little bit warmer now and the river does not freeze. But we do have, you know, a season on the upper section. There are slot limits on the river. The upper section actually is closed from March 31st till June 1st, and that's to allow for the main stem spawning to take place in the upper river. But that's only about a 4-mile stretch. The rest of the river remains open year-round. We did make some changes in the regulations over the years. One of the things that they developed here, because our fish are slow-growing, and, you know, of course, it's not stocked, they had to protect the numbers and so forth. So we have a slot limit. There's 2 different limits. One of them is on the upper river from the Fisher River to Libby Dam. That's a 13 to 24-inch slot limit, so a fish has to be 25 inches to kill in the upper river or under 13 inches, and that's the upper 4 miles of the river right below the dam. The rest of the river has a 13 to 18-inch slot limit. That worked really well on the Missouri River. That protects your spawning aged fish, and the rest of the river has, I think it's a 3-fish limit from 13 to 18 inches from the Fisher River Bridge down to the Idaho border. And I think Idaho, I'm not positive, but I think they have some kind of a 2-fish limit and possibly a slot limit on that stretch as well. You know, we don't keep fish when we're guiding, so I'm not real familiar with the rules down in Idaho.
Now, do you guide through the winter as well? Or?
Well, you know, when we have some skiers that want to do some fishing, it is possible to fish. You know, of course, we have temperature regards there because, of course, you know, you have the line freezing in the guides. But, yeah, I've guided pretty much every month of the season on the river. But, of course, you know, for somebody to book a flight and come in the middle of December, that's not necessarily something that you can guarantee.
Yeah.
So, you know, if somebody's coming through and wants to go out for a half day during inclement weather, and it's warm enough that we're not freezing our line and our guides, we're sure going to take them out.
Okay.
And that's the neat thing about the Kootenai is, you know, some of the best streamer fishing that we see is actually during the, you know, late fall and early winter seasons.
Okay. What you have mentioned a few fish. What are the primary sport fish that you fish for there?
Well, of course, we have the Columbia Red Band Rainbows, and then, of course, West Slope Cutthroats are the other trout that's in the river. Then we also have a char that's a Dolly Varden renamed bull trout. And the bull trout are an endangered species. They're a species of special concern. You can't, you know, fish for them. We do take bull trout incidentally, however, by fishing streamers in deep water, you know, with sinking lines while we're fishing for rainbows. And you know, since they've been protected, their numbers have grown in the river. And I had a fish, we didn't land it, but we had a fish on that was probably close to 4 feet in length. And that was one of the biggest bull trout I've seen on the river. We've hooked them up to 40 inches. I think our largest was 41 inches.
Wow.
In fact, a friend of mine that fishes out here quite a bit, we put one of his bull trout, because now you can do a IGFA record by not killing the fish, and so we just did a quick weight on the fish, and he got a world record bull trout on, I think it was 8-pound tippet. Just incidentally, while we were fishing up below the dam in about 20 feet of water, fishing a sinking line. So, you know, that's one of those. In Lake Kookanoosa, however, they do harvest bull trout. So, you know, it just varies. So
yeah. In
the lower river below the dam, there's a, you know, definitely a catch and release in law as far as the bull trout go.
Now, are there other species of rainbow besides the red band?
Well, we get some rainbow cutthroat hybrids, but no, that's basically... They did stock Kamloops rainbows in the reservoir above, you know, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. They do not stock rivers, but they stock lakes very heavily. And they put Kamloops rainbows in the dam, in the lake, above the dam to feed on some of the kokanee salmon that are up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the kokanee salmon are another species that get in the river below the dam, and occasionally we catch those on dry flies or even nymphs. And they're a landlocked sockeye that live, they have a 3-year cycle. And so a lot of the people that want fish to eat troll up in Lake Kookanoosa with different variations of spinning gear and that type of thing, and you can keep up to 20 kokanee a day. And I guess they are some of the best eating, you know, salmonids there are.
They are fun to catch on a fly rod, I'll tell you.
Yes,
that.
They sure are.
We've got some of them landlocked down here in Colorado, and we just had a blast one day on the East River catching those. So.
Yeah.
Now, and you said the bull trout is really not a true trout, but a char, like a Dolly Varden.
Right. Yeah. And we also have a few brookies. You know, the creeks like the Fisher River, the Yak River, a lot of the other rivers have brook trout in it. And so we do catch the occasional brook in the Kootenai, but it's not very common. You know, we might catch 2 or 3 brook trout a season, you know, with 5 to 6 guides going out there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't really see a lot of them. And then also in the lower Kootenai below the falls, there is a stream called Lake Creek that comes into the Kootenai above the town of Troy. And that small stream has brown trout in it. They think that the browns actually got in by somebody taking brown trout from the Bull River, which is real close to Bull Lake, which feeds Lake Creek. And so there was a little bit of bucket biology going on, and there are a few browns. In fact, the first documented brown came into my fly shop about 15 years ago by a bait fisherman that didn't know what kind of a fish he had, and he caught it right in the sturgeon pool that's right below Kootenai Falls. And I called up one of the biologists that came and verified it, took a statement from him and a picture, and that fish was about 24 inches and about 6 pounds. So,
wow. You
know, I have nothing against brown trout.
No, not with that fight.
It adds a whole other dimension.
Yeah. Well, we need to take another break here, Dave, but we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about the fish in the Kootenai River. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging into their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Blackburn about the Kootenai River. If you'd like to ask him a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, speaking of fish, Dave, what are can you kind of give me some average sizes of the main species there, and what would constitute a trophy fish as well for them?
Sure.
You already told us about the bull trout, so I think we know 4 feet is a pretty good size one. So.
Sure. Well, you know, you have to talk about, you know, the growth of fish and that type of thing. And we have, you know, a pyramid population, of course, with the older fish at the top, so to speak. And basically, you know, there are a lot of two-year-old fish, which are, you know, 8 to 10 inches. And the three-year-olds basically are from 10 to 12 or 13 inches. And that's generally speaking, you know, there's been biologists that say, you know, hey, this is a 13-inch fish, it might be 5 years old, you know. They're actually doing some studies now to determine, you know, what genetic traits develop into a six-year-old fish being, you know, 24 inches or 18 inches. And so basically the average size fish on the river is probably between 10 and 13 inches. You catch a lot of fish in that range. And then as you go up in size, you know, you just see fewer of the, you know, 18 to 20 inch fish. We don't average the same size fish that the Missouri River or the Bighorn have just because we don't have the growth rate and, you know, we don't have that primordial soup that is just super rich in nutrients that those rivers have where, you know, if you're wading in the Missouri or the Bighorn, you can't even see the bottoms of your boots in, you know, 2 feet of water. Where the Kootenai is very, you know, glacial fed, it's very clean, it's almost too clean in terms of it just doesn't have the high nutrient load. So, you know, smaller fish than those two other rivers, but great fish, and they love to fight. But we also do have, in contrast to that, we have the largest rainbows in Montana in this river. And that was proven about 6 years ago when a guy caught one below Libby Dam that was 33 pounds. And I think it was 38 inches long. And
right.
There's bull trout that are that big. And now, these are fish that are eating other fish. They're eating kokanee salmon that come through the wicket gates of the turbine. Some of them get damaged. Some of them make it through alive. But they put radio transmitters on some of these big, huge rainbows, and they check to see how they reacted to turbine changes. And basically, the biggest fish are the first ones where the outflow is, and they just set up a pecking order, you know, as the turbines change. And in fact, there's some really fun fishing right in that extreme tailwater stretch. You know, we've caught fish just on hopper patterns that are in the 28 to 30 inch range. And so that's a really cool thing about the river is the Kootenai will fool you. You know, you catch a lot of, you know, the smaller fish, and then all of a sudden, you know, you hook a fish that takes you into your backing, and then you never even see them.
Yeah.
And that's a nice aspect of the river. And so the people that catch the biggest fish are the streamer fishermen that want to work for it. I still don't think that it's anywhere close to steelheading and that I have about 8 days in on steelheading with a spay rod and still haven't caught one of those dang things. So I think you can, you know, if somebody's fishing a streamer hard in an eight-hour day, they're going to have a pretty good, you know, chance at catching, you know, one or two of these big fish. And, you know, it's just a matter of work. Not everybody wants to do that. And
well, we had a question come in on the Internet from Jeremy in Boulder, Colorado, and I think you've just answered his question, but he says, Dave, this is a simple question, but one whose answer is key to where I decide to travel. Do you catch fish over 20 inches on a regular basis? So I guess the answer is, well, if you work hard and, and you're fishing in the right spot, you could catch 20-inch fish on a regular basis, right?
We had one day of streamer fishing that was unbelievable, and I can still remember the day. I had a gentleman that everything must have been right because everywhere where I knew there were big fish, he caught one, and he caught five fish. The biggest one was probably 23 pounds, and the smallest one was probably 10 pounds. And that's pretty hard to beat considering it was a half-day morning trip.
Wow.
And it was just one of those things when the fish were eating, and a couple of those were bull trout, but three of them were rainbows, and, you know, I'll never forget that day. Plus, you know, I mean, it's just to be able to see those fish, to have the opportunity to hook them, you know, I consider it, you know, a privilege just to be able to have them on the line for a little bit. But to see what a fish like that does once it's hooked, you know, you're standing there awestruck as you're, you know, I remember one particular fish. We have a real heavy caddis hatch that happens right at dark, and I hooked a large rainbow while I was training one of the guides, and the fish came out of the water 10 feet, and just, you know, it was probably a 25, 26-inch rainbow, and it jumped like three times and then just broke me off. So, you know, there's not really much you can do, but you do have those experiences here, but, you know, they're not common everyday experiences.
Right, right. As in any river, you know.
Yep.
I mean,
right.
Unless you're in some outback river up in Alaska, you know,
sure,
where
sure.
Nobody goes, you might have
right.
A lot of, I mean, I remember fishing Cache Creek off the side tributary and fishing for dollies, and we didn't catch anything under 20 inches. But,
right.
You know, those places you have to spend a lot of time getting to nowadays to have
right.
This kind of thing. But in the lower 48, you got to work for them, and they're trophies. That's why they are trophies, is you don't catch
that's right.
One every other
that's
catch.
That's right, and there's such a thing, a wild trophy and native trophy, I think that's even
yeah.
Even more of a trophy than a stocked fish that's
sure.
Been eaten pellets and that's dumped in from the brood, you know, pond or whatever. So, you know, there's something to be said, you know, because I often get remarks from folks that are used to fishing stocked fisheries, like, for instance, the San Juan and the Green, you know, and that type of thing where they're running low on fish and they dump another 100,000 in. You know, that's nice and that's a good experience, but, you know, that isn't what nature provided. And to be able to catch a fish that's natural in nature, that thrives in that river, in that ecosystem, that hasn't been introduced by man, that's something special.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we got a question from Donald in Maryland, and he's curious about how late the fall or early winter fishing goes on in the Kootenai.
Well, that's the neat thing about the dam. Another positive point is, you know, tailwater fisheries don't cool off as fast as freestone rivers do. The third week of September, we usually have our first frost here, and it seems like after we have that first frost, the fish go into feed mode galore, where they just rise with reckless abandon. They're getting ready for winter, and we have water temperatures in the 50s all the way until Thanksgiving. So, you know, we won't see that temperature start dropping until probably, you know, in the mid-December to January period, and then we'll have temperatures only that go down to about 37 degrees. And, you know, I always kind of put the mark on the 40-degree mark when it, in terms of, you know, if fish are going to be active or not. But we've been out there at 38, 39 degrees fishing streamers and still catching some fish using slower retrieves and that type of thing. So, you know, in tailwater fisheries, you get a long extended season past the normal season in freestone rivers. Like, for instance, the Elk River, which is a tributary of the Kootenai that's just up in British Columbia that a lot of people go to fish for those cutthroat trout. I remember going up there in October and those fish almost, you know, being active for only 2 hours of the day because, you know, the water temperatures are in that 38, 39 because it cools off so fast up there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's something that's definitely a positive benefit to the tailwater.
So you're saying up until Thanksgiving, count on some pretty good fishing.
Yeah, in fact, dry fly fishing. In fact, we have, you know, midges, piranha mids, and we have a little mayfly called a little blue quill that hatches year-round. And so depending on, you know, whether it's going to be cold enough to freeze the line in your guides, you can catch fish on dry flies just about every month of the year. But, you know, that's, of course, concerning the air temperature.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I assume primarily you use drift boats to fish the river. Is that the case?
Yes, that's our primary mode of transport. We see a lot of rubber rafts. There's pontoon boats. There's certain sections, though, that you want to kind of have a little bit of training on before you get on. The Jennings Rapids area is a spot where I've seen boats sunk over the years. That's just downstream from us here, about half a mile. The China Rapids area is another stretch just above Kootenai Falls. It has some dangerous currents in it and that type of thing. Plus, when the river's up high, you also have whirlpools and back eddies that that if you're not familiar with how to get out of them, and you have a couple of guys that are leaning the wrong way in a boat, you know, you really have to be careful.
Yeah.
You see the occasional, you know, motor boats, just regular short, you know, row boats with motors on. In fact, this is about 10 years ago, three guys were fishing close to the mouth of the Yak, which has some very dangerous water in it. And because the Yak comes in and there's a big back eddy and you can actually get slammed into a wall, well, that's what happened to this motorboat. It had three guys. They must have had maybe 3 inches of gunwale clearance. And their motor quit on them and they went into the wall. Boat sunk. Two of them drowned. One of them made it out alive. He said he was standing on the bottom of the river and he could see the daylight up above and he kicked off the bottom and just barely made it out, but they found their two friends, you know, several days later downstream. So, you know, it's nothing to mess around with. You got to have respect for the river. And when I see people come that are used to doing, you know, some of the other rivers, the Missouri or the Bighorn, and, you know, basically you'll see them in inner tubes, not necessarily pontoon boats, but, you know, just regular, you know, like the Caddis boats and that type of thing. I've had three instances where I've saved people over the last 28 years being on the river. And, you know, you just have to have a healthy respect for this river. One gentleman was fishing too close to a gravel point, and the current gave out. I saw a canoe wrapped around a bridge abutment right by my house. Okay. And go ahead.
Scott in Oregon asked specifically, what are some good floats, say, half day and full day for an intermediate rower on the Kootenai?
Sure. The stretch below Libby is really good for that. It doesn't really have any super dangerous water. The upper river has one set of rapids called Jennings Rapids that, you know, you can stay to the right side and get around them pretty good. It, again, it depends on the flows and that type of thing. The stretch from Re-Rig to Town, which is Re-Rig is one of the takeouts that's called Osprey now, and between Osprey and Town is 8.5 miles of very easygoing water, and that's a good stretch too. So, you know, when people come into the shop with our own boats, we're very happy. We provide them with river maps, show them what stretch to do their shuttle, and, you know, provide fly suggestions and that type of thing. So we have a map that we give them and that type of thing. So, yeah.
What about Ron from Pennsylvania asked, how accessible is the Kootenai for wading fishermen?
It's wadable up to about 10,000 CFS. And at 10,000 CFS, the gravel on the shore is pretty much all covered. And there are still a few spots that you can wade fish above 10,000, but they diminish by almost half when you get to that level. Minimum flow, there's lots of wading areas. In fact, the nice thing about the Kootenai is there's very little private land along a lot of the upper river. And there's one side of the road that's owned by Plum Creek and the Forest Service, so you can drive on one side of the road. The highway side is all state right away. You can park in any wide pullouts and just walk down to the river's edge. It isn't a river that has a ton of private land along it. So there's Highway 2 below Libby where you can drive all the way down to Kootenai Falls and pretty much park anywhere and walk down to the river.
Okay.
So lots of public access.
Good, good. Which isn't always the case in Montana. So, yeah.
That's true.
Bighorn being one that is, you know, very tight with access.
Right.
Tim in Illinois asks, could you speak about the smaller rivers and streams and lakes in the area? That could be another whole show. But
sure.
He says, how about the Yak for the angler? And then he also asks about angler on a tight budget. Could you speak on places to stay, rent, camp?
Well, there's just a myriad of small streams in the area. Lots of tributaries that come into Lake Coconusa. Keep in mind that 90% of our county here, Lincoln County in northwest Montana, is owned by either the Forest Service or Plum Creek Timber, which is Plum Creek is private, but it's actually considered public in that they do not keep you off of their land. So 90% of this county is national forest. And so basically all the small streams that are within the Kootenai National Forest are fishable. They have lots of different species of fish. A lot of little rainbows, cutthroats, there's brookies in some of them. The Yak is a beautiful little freestone stream that we actually floated up until the second week of July. And there's a lot of great hatches that occur on these smaller rivers. And, you know, there's just no end. In fact, growing up in Pennsylvania, I grew up on fishing some of these smaller streams, and I just don't get a chance to do it the way I did as a kid, and because I'm always guiding on the big water. But we actually float the yak, and we do some walkway trips on Lake Creek. We also float the Bull River, which is a tributary of the Clark Fork. This is on the backside of the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness. And so there are some smaller rivers that we actually guide on with float boats up to a certain point. But the small little streams that are 3 to 4 feet across that have holes that are maybe 5 feet deep, there's tons of them in this area.
Mm. And we have
pretty much an undiscovered resource.
Question on the internet, Ben in Charlotte, North Carolina. He said, what section would be best to wade in late July? My whole family will be fishing the Kootenai this summer. This will include two boys ages 10 and 8.
Well, I would say there's a great stretch of wadeable river right above the Libby Town Bridge. And the flow is probably going to be at minimum or 6,000, and there's these great big islands that are in the middle of the river that you can hike up to and have lots of good fishing there. There's also some very good area in the top 3 miles of the river just below Libby Dam. That's the whole 4 mile stretch. Both sides of the river are controlled by the Corps of Engineers. There's campsites. That's one of the things that I wanted to mention with the other two, I think it was Tim.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he said on a tight budget, you know, there's campgrounds all over the place around here that are maintained by not only the Corps of Engineers but the Forest Service. And so the Corps of Engineer campsites, just to give an example, which are they own the immediate property that's adjacent to our property. There's an area called Blackwell Flats that has 7 to 10 campsites that you can stay there for 2 weeks fee-free, and they actually even bring you firewood. So that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah.
So you can do it on the cheap there if you want.
You sure
and,
can.
Be real close, too. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, Sharon in Nova Scotia, Canada, wants to know if she were to come down and fish, where would she go to find out about regs for the state fishing regulations?
Well, basically any licensed dealer will have the regulations. There's several areas where you can, or several shops. You can actually go online at just Google Montana fishing license, and you'll see the site where you can get an online license, and they actually have a PDF of the regulations, so she could do it right from her office if she has internet.
Great. Let's take a quick break here, and then let's talk about equipment and some flies and strategies and so forth. So we'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Blackburn about the Kootenai River. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, we've got Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas. This is a question from the Internet here, Dave. And he's asking, can Dave talk about the different rods that are used on the Kootenai, what one type has over the other? Does anybody fish bamboo? So.
Well, you know, just the other day, my last guide trip, I had a gentleman that I carried a little Sage One Weight in my boat for specific situations, and he liked it so well but didn't want to pay for the $800 price tag that that rod comes with. Of course, it has a reel with it and everything, but Temple Fork Outfitters came out with a One Weight, and so we sell Temple Fork in our shop, and I got him a One Weight in, and he came over from Big Fork and did a half day on the river, and it was one of those days where the wind wasn't blowing at all. There were little mayflies on the water, and he was able to fish that One Weight all day. That was a 7-foot, 8-inch One Weight rod. Now, that's not going to happen in a typical, you know, 5 days a week or even 2 days a week on the Kootenai, but it was kind of a neat little situation that developed with no wind, fishing small flies. So you can fish any various size rod on the Kootenai. The main rods that we use most of the time is just a 9-foot 5-weight, and we do see a lot of bamboo rods on the river. keep in mind, though, some of the older gentlemen that fish bamboos, you know, you get wrist fatigue. I mean, those rods are heavy, a lot of them, and with the, you know, newer generation graphite rods that came, you know, it really enabled people to fish those 8-hour days.
It's
hard to fish, you know, with, you know, the larger cane rods. Now, the smaller cane rods, you don't, you know, it's just almost like fishing graphite. But I'm thinking about a 9-foot, 6-weight, 3-piece bamboo rod. I mean, yeah, you know you fish that all day in your shoulder at the end of the day.
But well, now, yeah. Do you, I think on your website, don't you recommend to rig up 2 rods if you're in the boat?
Right. And we carry, you know, when guiding, one of the things that we do since we have the shop and everything is we always have extra rods rigged up. And we provide, it's almost like having a golf bag in the boat in that, well, here's a section here that we want to nymph fish. So give me that rod, we'll put that away, and we'll get the nymph rod out and nymph this. Oh, well, here comes a stretch that, let's throw a streamer right here. Rather than taking the time to cut off, re-rig and everything, we just have those rods ready to go. And we tell anglers, you know, bring a dry fly rod if you want to, but, you know, we actually provide gear and flies on our trips just to help out with the budget and so forth, but it's good to have those other rods ready to go, for sure.
Yeah. So usually 5-6 weight, it's good.
I would say a 9 for a 4 or a 5 that we're fishing our dry flies. Now, you know, with the exception of hopper season, most of our dry flies are pretty small here.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a growing number of green drakes that we're starting to see since our flows have been stabilized. And so we're fishing some, you know, 10, you know, drakes and drake cripples and that type of thing. But for the most part, our average size dries or mayflies are probably 16s and 18s. And so you don't really need a 6-weight rod to cast that. What I've found out is, you know, having a little bit, and it's just my philosophy and the way I was raised in fly fishing and so forth, I like softer rods where you can actually feel the fish a little bit more rather than the sage broomsticks that can cast a country mile but break off every fish if you have somebody that is a hard hook setter. So I like the softer tips a little bit more. Mm-hmm. We fish a lot of Winstons, and we've seen a lot of Thomas and Thomases. And, you know, there's a good, you know, kind of a medium to slow rod is what I like to see.
Yeah. I just keep thinking about the 4-foot bull trout.
Yeah.
And, I'm a little worried about hooking up with that on a 4-weight.
You know, we're fishing, the streamer rods are all 6s, 7s, and 8s.
Oh, okay, that makes me feel better.
So,
yeah,
you know, we're almost fishing like a steelhead. And, you know, we're fishing almost a straight 10 or 12-pound tippet on those, too.
Okay. Just want to get clear.
So that's just dry fly only at 4 weight.
David Schull in Dallas, Georgia, this is an internet question as well. He says, could you recommend a basic leader tippet system and top flies for the river? I'd like to talk about flies here in a minute separately, but can you tell us about what you recommend for leader and tippet for your clients and so forth?
Sure. Well, basically, again, it depends on your fly size that you're fishing. The smaller flies, I don't really like using 6X, but 5X is pretty standard on 16s. And, you know, we'll use fluorocarbon only in the fall for the most part, but for streamers we use fluoro pretty much all the time. And we use a 12-foot leader for the most part, unless we have the really glacial silt coloration that's taking place right now in the river that we have in the spring, and then we'll probably, you know, do a 9-foot leader. I like using a straight tapered leader. I don't like the loop-to-loop connections on the leader connection. I don't like furled leaders. I don't like the Orvis braided loops. We cut those off, and I tie on a stiff butt section of Maxima, probably about a 25-pound piece of Maxima, and then I nail knot. I don't loop-to-loop knot, but I nail knot the butt of that leader right to that section of Maxima. The least things you have to get caught up on when you're fishing a 1 or a 2 fly rig, for the most part, it's really important with a 2 fly rig. You have to have a heavy butt section to turn that leader over. If you don't, if you have a hinge, which what happens on the loop-to-loop connection sometimes, furled leaders have their place in nymphing, but they do not have their place on this river with fish and dry flies. They, number one, are heavy. They hit the water heavy. They throw water droplets everywhere. And I'm just not a big furled leader fan, except when it comes to nymphing, you know.
Okay.
So
good.
For dry flies, you know, a straight 12-foot to 5X, and I like a straight tapered leader with a heavy butt like a Dairiki or Orbis leaders have pretty heavy butts. The Climax leaders do too. Knotted leaders, I used to tie them all the time when I was a kid because it just saved money. But over the course of guiding and watching people with their casting habits and so forth, the least things to get hung up on and take you away from your time of having that fly on the water, I get rid of. And so, you know, we just don't use a lot of knotted leaders anymore when we're guiding.
Okay, good. Let's talk about food and flies on the river here. Got two questions here that are similar, so okay. I want to give them credit for asking. Len in England and Mark in Seoul, Korea,
wow.
Ways away. But both of them are asking basically what flies do you use? Len was asking three flies that you wouldn't go without on the river. And Mark's question was more about seasonal activity. So I thought maybe you could kind of walk us through, and we don't have a lot of time, so you'll have to keep this kind of brief,
sure.
But kind of walk us through the seasons and the hatches and what flies you might match to those hatches, because that's really what it comes down to.
Sure. Well, basically this time of year, we have blue-wing olives on the water. We've got western March browns. So, you know, I'm using a red quill a lot of time, which is a quill-bodied fly tied with blue dun hackle and tail. We just tie traditional. I'll also use sparkle duns in varying colors. That's a Craig Matthews pattern. It has a comparadun type deer hair wing with no hackle whatsoever, and then a trailing shuck. We also are starting to see some granum caddis right now, and one of our main caddis patterns on the river is an X-caddis tied with varying colors. That X-caddis is nice because it simulates a caddis that's coming out of its pupil shuck, and it remains attached, and it kind of, you know, wiggles out, and that's a time when the fish knows it better get it before it gets away. So if you get picky fish, that little trailing shuck really helps. Another just kind of a search pattern that we use is, you know, a royal wolf. I tie it a little bit differently. We use a moose mane tail, and it's a good attractor pattern. People, you know, often say, well, you know, what flies are you using? And I say royal wolf, and they say, oh, yeah, right, you know. But in pale morning duns, we tie a different pattern there. We use like a sparkle dun. We also tie it parachute style. So, you know, I can't really take it down to three flies. But, you know, for instance, now another pattern that we're using is a black ant. You know, there's carpenter ants that are coming out in flight now. It's a terrestrial insect. It's not coming out of the river, of course, but that's another fly that we'll use as a dropper. Just fish it like a nymph, and we'll actually even wet it to get it to sink, and that's a great fly to use as well. In July, we basically see heavy pale morning dun and tan caddis hatches. That's a hydrocyte caddis. They're net spinners. We use an X-caddis pattern for that. We'll see some green drakes in early July, and we tie just a traditional drake pattern. You can also use a parachute drake. Moving into, you know, in the fall, late summer, you start using hopper patterns. We just keep the hopper patterns mixed up. We use a lot of Turk's tarantulas and that type of thing. We use stimulators. We use bullet head hoppers. And there's a myriad number of foam hopper patterns that all work. I think the main thing is to keep it mixed up, because when we're guiding every day and putting the flies in front of the fish every day, to just mix it up and keep them on the edge, because they'll see that. You know, who knows if they recognize flies, you know, but we always tend to anthropomorphize, make human thinking fish as fly fishermen. So midge patterns pretty much all year. We use a cluster midge tied like a Griffith's gnat. That's a great fly to use. As far as the blue-wing olives, standard ties there work. Again, this river doesn't see a whole lot of pressure, so you can get away with, you know, the lack of using cripple patterns. We use cripples occasionally and that type of thing when we find tougher fish, but these fish are not Henry's Fork fish. They do not have PhDs in fly identification where you work 3 hours to catch one fish with the number, you know, 22 PMX emerger, you know, so.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yep. And then there's some mahogany duns in the fall. We have a big caddis in the fall that's an October caddis, or cinnamon sedge, some people call them, and we use like a big cinnamon stimulator, or a dark orange-bodied Turk tarantula works pretty good. And there's also even an aquatic moth here that's in the Lepidoptera family and they actually hatch out of the river, and it's fun. It's funny to watch some of the rainbows. You know, they're laying their eggs, you know, and they have a very erratic flight, and to see a fish miss one two times, and then the third time he gets it right and comes out of the water and grabs one. That's pretty cool.
Well, it sounds like you've got a little bit of everything up there.
We do.
In the way of insects.
We do.
Just pick your time of year, and you can fish whatever you want, it sounds like.
That's right.
That's terrific. Let's talk a little bit about some strategies and tactics and so forth here. Dan in Redmond, Washington asks, in unknown waters, what's your first fly or flies to use as a searching pattern when using a floating line? And keep specific to the Kootenai.
Sure.
Do you have a searching pattern? Or?
Yeah, that depends on the time of the year. We change it. In the early season, you know, I would put on like a small stonefly dry and maybe put a little pheasant tail bead head or possibly even a black ant underneath. Moving to like in mid-season, maybe an elk hair caddis tied with a little PT nymph or a smaller like a PMD emerger or even a small hare's ear type pattern. I like the combination flies, although you know you do have to check them often and to make sure you know they're not getting twisted up. And I do my rigging a little bit differently on small shank, just a standard shank hook. I'll tie my back fly right to the eye rather than the bend of the hook, which is how we tie our hopper-type patterns or stimulator-type patterns. We tie our second fly into the bend of the hook. But when we're fishing a caddis with maybe a pupil emerger or a soft tackle behind it, which is another search pattern that we use, I like the back end of that front fly to be free swinging because we actually do catch a lot of fish on the swing on the Kootenai. And so if you have that fly tied to the bend of the hook, the back fly controls the body of the front fly, so, you know, I've always done that eye to eye on the smaller shank hooks, and not everybody does that. In fact, there's
right.
another way that we do it, too, where you actually just tie the dry fly, put it on the tippet, but don't tie it, just let it go freely up and down the tippet with a nymph underneath, and that, you know, works effectively, too, at
that's
times.
Interesting, yeah. A lot of people tie tags off, you know, too, to get that.
Right, right, fly. And you know, the thing with tags is when you're casting a whole lot, and you're not, you know, when you're fishing out of a drift boat and you have wind, those tags just inevitably become so twisted. That's how I grew up. I fished. In fact, you can only use two flies in Montana, but in Pennsylvania you can use as many as you want. We used to use a standard three-fly tag system using the tag end of a blood knot, and I'd leave about 3 inches, and we tied pretty stiff leader material, which helped with the twisting too. So
that
across and down swing in any river in Montana that has caddis in it is a very effective way to search when you're in a riffle with a drop-off.
Question, Dan in Newport, Washington. He says, what's your favorite June fishing tactic on the river? Now, I don't know why he picked June. Maybe he knows something I don't know. But
well,
does that have some significance?
Well, June is, you know, we have off-color water in that we don't have the same visibility. Like, for instance, a month ago, we still had fall visibility in that we were seeing 20 feet of underwater visibility. Now we've got runoff started, and we have a little bit of glacial silt in the river, and it's basically 5 to 6 feet of visibility. So we're using a little bigger flies in June. When we're not nymphing, which is we would nymph if there's no fish, no sign of fish coming up, I'm fishing down about 8 feet to the first fly underneath an indicator. You know, Westwater Products makes those new balloon-type indicators that aren't balloons, but they work just like them. And it holds up. I tie up one of my Umpqua patterns was a Da-Bomb nymph. It's a sparkle chenille-tied nymph that looks like it's ready to pop. And then we'll put a smaller little pheasant tail beadhead or a prince beadhead or any myriad of smaller nymph behind it. I tie the first, the Da-Bomb, with a, it has a tungsten bead plus a lead body. So it sinks like, you know, I don't like really using lead, and so I lead that first fly heavy, and that gets it down fast, but it also catches a lot of fish on that pattern, and that pattern gets requested still from some people that are looking for it. And so the second nymph is maybe 18 inches below the other one, so we're fishing down 8.5, 9, sometimes 10 feet, but if you're not close to the bottom, when fish aren't really that active, you're not going to move many fish. And again, in shallower waters, we'll just adjust that nymph up to about, you know, 4 to 5 feet, maybe even 3 feet. And then the other June tactic is just put on, you know, a bigger dry fly. We have a silver striped caddis that's on the river too, that's similar to the October caddis, and it's kind of a tan bodied, so we might use like a tan tarantula or a tan stimulator and drop a big old carpenter ant wet off of it, and that's very effective. In fact, we caught half of our fish the other day on a sunken ant pattern. And
we got
carpenter ants are, as soon as the weather gets warm, they're all over the place, and fish love to eat them.
Question from Dave in Lewiston, Utah. He asks about, on large rivers, what do you consider productive water? What things cause more than a casual look as you float along and perhaps throw a cast or two? So could you kind of talk just, and we're getting real short on time, but I'd like you to talk just a little bit about how to read a larger river like that and
sure.
find
well,
a place where the fish are.
A large river can be pretty intimidating to most people the first time they see it. And, you know, I get people that, you know, see the river at maximum flow. I had one guy that came here. I'd been guiding on the river 20 days straight, and he got here, and he didn't want to, he thought that the water was too high to fish, and it took, you know, well, listen, you know, we had a 50-fish day today, and it took a lot of convincing. I finally got him to go fishing the next day, and he had never seen anything this big. And, you know, basically, if you just take a big river and realize that a deep run, rather than being 100 yards on the Madison or the Missouri, it's a half mile long. A pool could be, you know, rather than, you know, 50 yards long, it's 150 yards. You just have to kind of, the sections are different. A riffle might be, you know, 200 yards of riffle water. So, you know, the Kootenai reminds me of a lot of the steelhead rivers, you know, where they're big, and you just have to, you know, and what holds big fish is, you know, the structure. The structure on the bottom holds big fish. They need three things. They need the security in a place, a resting spot, and they need food. And if they have all those three things, and we've catch some of our fish, some of our biggest fish are caught behind the same rocks every season, season after season. You catch one there, and, you know, of course, you know, we're putting them back, so that fish is back there. But even if that fish moves on, another one will take his place. And I'm not talking small boulders. I'm talking about tractor, trailer, cab-size boulders that are in the bottom of the river. And the river does have deep sections. And, you know, we had a double hooked up a few years back, and, you know, one of them was a 10-pound rainbow, the other one was a 15-pound bull trout, all in one area where there was big rocks with good holding water.
Now, we're out of time, but I do have one more question here from the Internet. He says, Dave, talk about, this is Dave Burton in Pensacola, Florida. Dave, talk about the bull trout in the river, best way to fish for them. He says, what a kick it was to have the monster, I guess he was referring to monster bull trout, eat my rainbow.
Right. and that actually happens. In fact, we had it happen two trips ago. A big fish came up and took a 12-inch rainbow right off the line. And the head of the bull trout was probably, you know, a foot long, you know. So we don't, again, if you're sight fishing for bull trout, if you see one in the river, that's highly illegal. You're not supposed to do that. But
you're not supposed to fish for them at all.
For catching rainbows, big rainbows or big bulls, you're not necessarily pinpointing what fish you're taking. The Kootenai is too deep for that, you know. You may see a fish here and there and be able to identify it, but we know where the big fish are, whether they be rainbows or bulls, and we have no control over whether a bull trout eats a streamer or a rainbow, but you do have to, you know, release it as soon as you get it in and that type of thing. So purposely fishing for bull trout is illegal, but
okay.
Incidental takes happen regularly on this river. Let me put it that way.
Fish deep for rainbows.
Yep.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yep.
Well, good, good. That's a good note to end on, and we always want to stay legal, too. So.
Sure.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up, but when we return, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and we'll also be giving away a cap and T-shirt, courtesy of Dave Blackburn and Kootenai Anglers. So hang tight here, and we'll get to that in just a minute. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout flat fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's savebristolbay.org, and there you'll learn more about how you can get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage. In the section under tonight's show, it says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. So we have, first of all, those that registered for the drawing will be eligible for these first two prizes. And to do that, you had to register on our homepage there. It's too late now, but make sure you do it next time because we're always giving away some great gifts. And our first gift tonight is 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you're not familiar with the Federation, go to their website. It's at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, international organization dedicated to fly fishing and conservation. So good organization to be part of. Now, our winner for that is John Burton in Oregon, and we just answered his question. So that's great. What timing. So, John, congratulations. If you've already got a membership, we'll get it extended for you. So we'll be sending an email to get your information so that we can get that membership started for you. So congratulations. And then we're giving away that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And our winner there is Shane Cavett in Texas. Shane Cavett in Texas. So congratulations, Shane. And if you want to know more about Fly Fusion Magazine, go to flyfusionmag.com. flyfusionmag.com. They're out of Calgary, Canada, just a few miles north of Libby, Montana, and they produce a great magazine that I know you like. Now, the cap and T-shirt that Dave's so kindly giving away tonight, we need a question. So I'm going to ask a question. Let me just make sure my cue is cleared here. Now, if you're going to answer this question, you got to be on our homepage. There's a text box there. First person to submit answer to the question correctly along with their location and their name will win this cap and T-shirt. So the question is, a bull trout is not really a trout. What is it? Bull trout's not really a trout. What is it? So let's see here, Dave, if anybody was paying attention. So we're just double-checking here, and we got our first answer from Frederick Hodge in Elmhurst, Illinois. He says a char. Did he get it right, Dave?
He did.
He did. Well, congratulations, Frederick. You got a cap and a T-shirt coming from Kootenai Anglers, and you'll need to email me your, or in the text box on our homepage, you can put in your address and contact information. You might want to say what size T-shirt you want, right, Dave? So that Dave
right.
can get that
yes.
right and send it out to you. So send me that information in that text box or send it via email to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get you those prizes out there, Frederick. So congratulations on all three of you winners tonight, and appreciate you all listening. And Dave, hey, really appreciate you being with us.
Hey, it was my privilege. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's always fun.
Hour and 20 minutes went by awful fast.
Yeah, that's usually what the guests say. Yep. 90 minutes? What are we going to talk? I said, no problem. Don't worry about it. Well, we will run out of time. We always do. So, but it was fun learning about the Kootenai River and got my fishing juices going here, and sounds like a place I'm going to have to visit someday. So
good.
I appreciate your time. Well, our next broadcast will be on June 2nd, and that's going to be 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Doc Thompson, and our topic for the show will be the wild rivers of northern New Mexico. Doc is a professional guide of 15 years, and he's been taking fly fishers to where the fish are in the wild rivers of northern New Mexico, including the Rio Grande, the Cimarron, and the Rio Castilla. So listen in to learn about these unique fisheries and how to fish them. So we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would like to benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 800-985-1673. 1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.